You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as The Daily Meditation Podcast, The Accidental Creative, and I Know What Scares You. If you'd like to advertise on the show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. The story you're about to hear is somewhat frustrating. We hear so many UFO stories where one or two people see something unusual in the sky that changes their lives but leaves no physical trace. But what if a UFO was seen by thousands and did leave physical traces and still remains a mystery? And what if this wasn't in some rural retreat, but in a very urban setting? Join us today as we hear about the 1954 Florence UFO incident with investigator Massimo Polidoro.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Maybe the hardest lesson of investigating paranormal mysteries is that you can't always know with certainty what happened. Sometimes there's just not enough to go on. Sometimes evidence is lost or destroyed. And sometimes the folklore of a story outraces any attempts to corral the facts where they can be studied carefully. Italian skeptical investigator Massimo Polidoro has certainly run into this across the hundreds of cases that he's researched. Karen and I really enjoyed having him on for some
Monster Talk.
We're so excited to have you on.
It's the first time. Can you believe it?
I know.
Yes,
it's shameful. Yes. It's shameful.
It is, yeah. We're embarrassed.
On our part, right.
Left it too long. Yeah, not to have you on.
Well, no, to me, you're sort of skeptic famous, but I guess people who don't know your work should be introduced to you. Do you have a sort of standard elevator pitch for who is Massimo?
Well, I don't know if you want. I can,
where do you begin?
I can do something, yes.
Well, otherwise, I will introduce you as a person who's trained in psychology and who works extensively with skepticism and critical thinking and is currently spending time at Harvard.
Yeah.
Wow.
We want to hear about that, too.
And you've published like 1,000 books. Is that right? Yeah. I think it's 1,015.
Probably. 62.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Six, yeah. That is amazing.
That's impressive. He's got his own YouTube channel as well.
Yeah.
Not in English, though.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. but eventually we'll get there.
Well, I'm excited because the case we're going to talk to or speak about today is one of those mysterious and weird UFO stories that I hear all the time because so many witnesses were involved. So I'm anxious to hear about this story. So can you sort of, I guess we'll just get started and hop in with, can you tell us about the UFO case in Florence in October 1954 that took place on a soccer pitch or a football
in front
field?
Of 10,000 people?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that day was October was soccer. You know, soccer is very popular in Italy, and it was the home team, Fiorentina, Florence team, but against another team from another Tuscany town from Pistoia. So they were playing, but what happened during the game was that some people started to look up, because in the sky there were two objects flying very high, and so the referee decided to stop the game for a few minutes so that the players could look up and see what was going on, because something unusual happened, which is that some strange white substance started to fall down very slow, very similar to cotton wool, and was very unusual, and some of it would disintegrate while falling, and some other could be touched, but then very easily it would disintegrate again and turn into powder. What's interesting is that a student from university who had seen this and was there as a witness was able to pick up a few of these similar cotton wood substance and take it into a small bag and then take it to the chemistry institute at university in Florence. So in order to have it examined, because, you know, immediately newspapers started to say that UFOs had gone over Florence, and 10,000 people or probably less saw them, and there was this substance that was falling down from the sky, inexplicable substance. So the question is, what did they see and what happened that day in Florence above this soccer field? Well, the analysis of the substance said that it was like sort of a silicious form of a cotton wool, without telling exactly what it could be. One hypothesis that was presented, was put forward, was that probably could be, was an idea, a form of spider ballooning. You know, there are some spiders that, in order to migrate, they produce like a web parachute, let's say, to make it easy to understand. And through, you know, the help of the wind, they could fly very, very high, even 4 kilometers in height, and thousands of kilometers away. They could even, you know, really change countries by traveling this way. However, problem is that the substance of these webs, web substance, is different from the one that was examined at the chemistry laboratory. So it was probably something else. Maybe there was some falling, probably because the October is the month in which this takes place, this ballooning takes place. But it most certainly was not what was picked up. So this became a mystery, especially for Italian ufologists, let's say. So it kept on being repeated and repeated, and appeared there was no possible solution except for thinking that UFOs flew over Florence and left some mysterious substance over the city.
Must be. Yeah.
Must be. What else? What else could it be?
Only other alternative. Yeah.
Well, they were watching the game, right?
Yeah, so. But you know, very, very recently, actually, one Italian colleague of mine from CICAP, which is the Italian Committee for
for the investigation of claims on pseudoscience, Francesco Grassi, that's about 8 years ago, mm-hmm. found that there is actually a substance that has the same chemical structure, which is it is called chaff. Chaff is a material that is produced for military reasons since the 1930s as a way of deflecting radars from enemy.
Right. It scatters the radar signal, so it doesn't come back.
Exactly. So they just throw off this substance, which messes up the enemy's radars, and they're able to fly away. I mean, the airplanes, of course. Mm-hmm. So this would have been a possibility. So the next question was, yes, but were there airplanes doing maybe, you know, some kind of...
like a military exercise? Or...
Reconnaissance, or
And in fact, he found out that very close to Florence, in the sea, there was an American airplane carrier. His name is USS Lake Champlain. And there mm-hmm. were a few military airplane VF-84 sidewinders, for those who are experts on these things, and they were actually doing exercise, let's say, on the Italian skies between October 21 and October 27, which is 1954, which is the last day and the day in which the phenomena took place. So the idea is there are military airplanes. They are doing their thing over Florence sky in the exact same day. Could it be that they were, you know, dispersing this chaff over the sky as being part of what they had to do? It's a question that, of course, today we cannot answer. We don't have we cannot go farther than this. Mm-hmm. But at least it provides a possibility and a reasonable alternative possibility to the idea of the UFO invasion.
Right, a much more natural explanation than a lot of others that have been posited. But isn't it the case that there were lots of other sightings that coincided with this event, which I guess fits in with the explanation that you've just given too? Of course, you had sightings in America around that time. It was really the heyday for those kinds of sightings.
Of course, UFO sightings were very popular in those years, especially in Italy after, you know, the 1947 wave, after Kenneth Arnold first sighting and talking about flying saucer for the first time, and everybody was seeing flying saucers everywhere. Yes, it was everywhere, and people were very alert at that. And so everything that flew in the sky could be exchanged for a UFO or a... Of course, as the interpretation goes, an extraterrestrial ship flying over us. So, in that specific case, the sightings that were confirmed were those above the soccer field. So, the possibilities that those two things flying could have been maybe military airplanes. So, but again, this is not a closed case. It's still open and probably will remain open. But Occam's razor tells us that, the easiest explanation probably is correct.
I would say Occam's razor's taken down more UFOs than any air defense tools that we have. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Indeed.
I'm curious about... because any kind of mass sightings you get, like when you get the gatherings at Fatima, you know, and you have, like, when you have thousands of people, always
communal reinforcement.
Well, there's communal reinforcement, but I'm also always curious about, like, how over time it becomes accepted that everybody saw the thing, and including you know, if people who didn't see it were there, they might feel like maybe they did see it. But I don't do you have any sort of sense of how widely this was visible? Like, how many people saw the stuff falling from the sky? How many people saw the things in the sky? Or how many people just, why have they stopped the game? What's going on?
Yeah, we don't have actually, you know, data on that. So we can only surmise and we can only make some guesses because it was not recorded in any way. But it went out in the newspapers the following day. And so probably many who were there maybe didn't see anything, but said, you know, yeah, something strange happened, but I didn't exactly see what. Because that's what happens usually with this kind of events. So a few people see something strange, others that are maybe close by are, you know, engaged in this exciting experience, and they start to think about it. Yep, so maybe I saw something, maybe. And, you know, with time passing, the maybe becomes a yes, of course. And the memory is, as we know, is not a recording. It's not something that stays exactly the same with the passing of time, but it changes.
Right.
And every time that we tell a story, we change it a little bit without even noticing, of course, making it more interesting, more coherent, maybe. And in the end, we find ourselves with an inexplicable story that is completely different from the original one, but we have no way of verifying or confirming that.
True. Right. Yeah. Has this story changed significantly over the time? Or have you noticed? I know people's memories change, but a lot of times the stories change. I'm thinking here about how things have changed in places like Roswell.
The embellished.
Rendlesham Forest. There's so many cases where what was reported initially is so wildly different from what gets, you know, later on.
At the time, yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, in this case, you know, there were others that added additional sightseeing that were not even close or had nothing to do with that. But that's how it goes, you know, in order to make it even more strange, even more apparently inexplicable, you start to add things. And in the end, if you don't get to the original reports, you have no idea of what really took place, probably took place.
Right. Yeah. And it seems like there were a number of eyewitnesses that day who are still alive and persist in telling stories. So not only some of the players, but fans as well, who just seem very passionate. They've stuck to their beliefs. I don't know if the stories have embellished over time, but I've just in watching videos on YouTube, it seems like there are a few people who are really passionate about this story and have even developed some degree of fame just by talking about it.
Well, that's quite common, as you know very well, because once you are a part of an incredible story, you want to tell everybody. And as I said, you make it a little bit more interesting, a little bit more coherent, a little bit more rich with details that were not there in the beginning. And
absolutely,
you come up with a fantastic story that, as we said, probably it's completely different from what happened in the first place. But it's so exciting and so, you know, it gives you so much satisfaction to be at the center of this thing that you don't see the problem.
Right.
True. Help an American audience understand. What is what's the newspaper culture like in Italy? I get a vibe that there are.
And at that time.
Well, and at that time, true. Mm. Yeah, it was like, I'm like, we run into a lot of things where you get one kind of coverage in the mainstream papers and another kind of coverage in the tabloids. You know,
yes.
So did you get a sense for how this story broke at that time and what the sort of, like, was it picked up by every newspaper or was it more of a fringy kind of thing?
It was picked up by some national newspapers, yes. In Italy, we don't have a tradition of tabloids, so it's mainly, you know, regular newspaper like we would have here, making the due difference and the due proportions, what the Washington Post, the New York Times, of the equivalent, let's say, in Italy, some of those gave the news as well. It was something odd that happened, and it was reported like that. But of course, being an age in which UFOs were everywhere and everybody was seeing UFOs, and in Italy, 1954 is a special year for UFOs. You find the word UFO in the titles, of course.
How popular is the belief in UFOs today in Italy? Because it seems like that it could very easily set up a firm tradition of interest in that topic.
Oh, it's very popular, not much because of this episode or other Italian episodes, but mainly because today we see a return of the mass interest in UFOs from the Pentagon videos, from the commission, all the public events that have been taking place, especially in America. And mm-hmm. so that helped a lot in reviving the whole UFO scene in Italy. But what we see today is, in a way, it's similar to some episodes that were also evident back then. But mm-hmm. today is much more clear that those who are become very strong believers in UFOs are not interested in the scientific aspects of the of what they could be or if they have a possible explanation. It becomes a sort of a substitute of religion.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Because the belief is there and it's unshakable, and you cannot discuss about a possible alternative explanation with these persons, because to them it's true, and if you doubt about it, you are paid by someone in order to discredit the whole field, and so you have hidden reasons, and because everybody knows that this is really extraterrestrials. And as I said, it's becoming a form of a religion, because to many in Italy and in many other places, of course, in the United States, traditional religions becomes less and less, let's say, believable, acceptable in a scientific and technological age like we live in. And instead, thinking about creatures that are superior to us and in a way created us maybe thousands or millions of years ago and gave birth to civilization, and they still observe us and maybe protect us from going the wrong way, becomes a substitute of the God that is much more difficult to accept in a technological society. But the UFOs are quite acceptable.
Well, we see a lot of parallels there, and not just in UFOs. Yeah. I think maybe even in cryptozoology, I think in some ways, Bigfoot, Bigfoot has become sort of a nature religion in some ways.
Yeah.
And the UFOs, like you say, they sort of are they give you a secular spiritualism. But in this, On the one hand, I know that there's people who are doing research. I'm thinking of like Pasulka, who are saying there's a new religion emerging. But you could also look back and say, well, all the original contactees were basically riffing on theosophy. I mean, they were doing sort of a theosophical take on space brothers who were coming to you know, protect the Earth and deliver us from ourselves. And I think that religion stuff is not very well hidden. I think it's it's not deep below the surface. It's right up there at the top.
Oh yes, absolutely. And there is a lot, as you say, a lot of interesting research, especially on how our supernatural beliefs are, you know, not only born and present in humankind, but also because we see that avoiding or prohibiting even religion, there are so many examples, and the USSR is one of them. If you even prohibit religion, it does not take away the supernatural urge to explain the world in a supernatural way, because that was something that was helpful, was towards survival, I mean, in the evolution of our species. Because if you start to see things in nature around you, if you start to find meaning even when there is no meaning, you have more possibilities of surviving, because eventually sometimes there are meanings there to be seen. And if you are alert to them, you see them. Many times there are no meanings and there are no intentions in what is taking place. But the possibility of missing one of those useful links is much more, it's much more important not to miss it rather than, you know, not see it when it's there, because you risk of not surviving and not leaving to your descendants the same trait, and you will not, and they will not survive, of course. And those who have a strong fantasy, let's say, and start to imagine that there is a danger even when there is none, you know, they're more likely to survive, because if you don't see the danger, and the danger once in a while is there, you get eaten by the tiger or whatever it is hiding behind the bush, and you're not giving that same kind of skeptical, let's say, approach to your descendants. Mm.
We've talked a bit of, like, I've come to the conclusion that skepticism and irrational thinking are kind of a technology, and they have to be taught and they have to be practiced. And if you don't do those things, you know, then they just don't become part of your tool set. Like, they're not there for when you need them. So, like, you have to
maintained.
Hone them.
Maintained.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
It's a chore. Yeah. Skepticism's a chore.
Absolutely. Many like, ways. You know, like science, because it's counterintuitive. You have really to, you know, doubt in things. It's a job. It doesn't come easy to us. We are prone to believe because, you know, we have this, it is called truth default mechanism, that leads us to accept things that are said to us, because it would be too expensive to doubt everything.
It's also super annoying.
Super annoying.
A lot of people.
You would find yourself, you know, isolated in a group. And
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bunch of people roll their eyes. But
I did want to just circle back to the event in October 1954 just once more. I wanted to ask you, Massimo, if there's a lot of video on YouTube and elsewhere that purports to be from this event. So are you aware of any surviving footage or photographs?
No, it's probably made up, because there's nothing. It was not filmed and it was not photographed. It happened so quickly that it is not like today that we have, you know, cell phones and we are ready to take pictures.
Right.
It was a time where owning a camera was a big deal, and you certainly would not, you know, film things that are not your family or what is important to you.
Well,
yeah, that puts things in a whole new light. There's a lot of information that's out there.
Well, really for sure. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, every time I hear this case, I'm always brought back to think about some of the more Fortean phenomena, because the stuff falling from the sky, it was described as being silver or glittery, but people immediately rolled
angel
to
hair.
Angel hair.
Angel
hair is a Fortean thing. That's more like star jelly or what they call powder. I don't know how it's pronounced. Powder cere or this. Mm-hmm.
Online guides suggest the Welsh term is closer to poudre cere, also known as the rot from the stars, which is both a fascinating Fortean topic, to which I will link in the show notes, as well as a superb band name if someone hasn't already snagged it.
Yeah, but that concept of either some substance falling from the sky, and that's what I always hear people ascribing it to, but the actual silvery part doesn't sound like that at all. It doesn't sound like the Fortean thing. And
different things.
Even John,
have you seen some of the pictures online? Look like that, like ectoplasm, like pictures from Victorian
seances.
Yeah,
and I don't think any of those are from the actual case. I don't think.
And, well, apparently not.
But they get labeled and it was like that werewolf case where there's the woman's photo that was associated with it, where it had nothing to do with anything. But on the internet, things can become entwined, and it's kind of like in quantum physics where you have like two particles that are entangled. This nonsense can get entangled with the real stuff, and they just get dragged along. So I kind of hate that, but it's the whole thing about it might be chaff is really interesting. I'd like to hear more about that, because John Keel even ran into some cases like that, and of course it sounded exactly like chaff. It fit everything, and then he was like, "But it's probably not chaff. It was probably chaff. It was
got to sort the wheat from the chaff, right?
That's right. Nice, Karen. That should have been my joke.
Learning from you.
Oh my God. I'm going to just slink off in shame now. Okay.
Blake is very well known for his puns. Let's put it that way.
That's true. Well, tell us while we have you here, because and we need to have you back because you've covered much stuff.
We do.
Tell us, why are you at Harvard? What's going on?
Well, you know, this is a great opportunity, of course. I needed to take a sabbatical because I've been doing a lot of work for a long time. As I mentioned before, I started with Randy. I was his apprentice when I was 18. So it's been, and my first book I wrote when I was there with him in Florida.
Wow.
And I never stopped since then, writing books, giving lectures, holding courses, and now social media, of course, it takes a lot of time. Every once in a while you need to stop and think about things. And in looking around, I was talking with Professor Naomi Oreskes. She's the historian of science here at Harvard, the Department of the History of Science, and the author of Merchants of Doubt.
Oh, I know that book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm sure. And so in talking, she said, "Why don't you come here?" Which, it's fantastic. Invitation. How could you? So that's why I'm here, because of that fantastic invitation. And I'm here also to do some research and to do some, to go deeper into some subjects that are really a pet of mine, one of which is the relationship between magic and science. Magic meaning prestidigitation, magic like in Randi, Copperfield, and magic, Houdini magic. And at Harvard, in Boston especially, there was a very famous episode that took place in the 1920s when the Scientific American examined Boston medium Marjorie. Oh yeah, and Houdini was a member of that committee examining her. Yes,
listen, I've been wanting to talk about
like
that.
Sounds like another episode.
Yeah, you should definitely come back and talk about if you've done research.
I will tell you all about it.
Yeah, no, that's such a cool... we'll do the full hour. We'll take a full hour because there's a lot to cover in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, but there is a very interesting relationship between science and magic, I would say, from the 18th century with Mesmer and magnetism mm-hmm. to the 20th century with parapsychology and the paranormal, and before that with spiritualism, which is now less strong, let's say, because very often it was magicians, not scientists, who saw deception and mm-hmm. were helpful, and you know, like instruments, like a telescope or a microscope to the scientist in order to ascertain what was really going on.
Yeah. Well, that Marjorie case is quite an interesting one. I've read a couple of books about it. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I would be very happy to talk about that. And you're right. And that's what Randy never stopped talking about, was that the scientists' biggest problem is they can easily be fooled themselves, and they need to have someone trained mm-hmm. in deception to help them sort of get through those weeds.
Don't like to say that they don't know either.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's another sort of, I think, one of the perils of too much skepticism is it can leave you it's difficult to make decisions sometimes, because certitude is not something that comes to you once you really start sort of dissecting things. You have to make those sort of, you have to use heuristics and kind of get through it, because eventually you got to make a decision.
Eventually, yes.
Well, Massimo, it's just been delightful having you on the show finally.
Pleasure, really.
And we're going to have to have you back again. But in the meantime, we always ask our guests this final question, a signature question. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite monster?
Well, my favorite monster, I would say it's probably Dracula.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And that's some sort of werewolf or something? What's
Dracula is a vampire.
He's teasing.
Quite teasing. But our previous guest that we just had on was talking about the English village of Whitby, which figures mm-hmm. prominently in the book. So this is very topical.
Legends associated with Dracula. Uh-huh.
Is Dracula popular in Italy?
Not specifically, but... for one documentary, I had the occasion of spending some time in Romania and in Transylvania, and tracing the origins of the myth that was eventually caught by Bram Stoker for his book. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting, you know, to find the historical roots of something that is a complete fiction, of course.
Yeah.
That has some... let's say some hints of truth, not in the fact that vampires are real, but that a figure like Count Dracula was inspired by a real historical figure, Vlad mm-hmm. Tepes, who was a typical, king of the time, very ruthless and very blood-seeking, but not in order to drink the blood, even if there are tales of him drinking the blood of his enemies in order to make him more despicable, of course. Mm-hmm. And this is another aspect of the whole story, which is the birth of fake news back then. Oh, yeah, because the print was just beginning, and there were already booklets and pamphlets filled with fake stories that were needed in order to put a bad light on your enemy. So mm-hmm. when
propaganda.
We think, propaganda also, mm-hmm. yes. But outrageous fake news, like he was drinking the blood of his enemies and whatever. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, the other thing is that the name itself, Dracula, probably came from the fact that Vlad was a member of this group and was called Dracul, son of the dragon. So there are many, many interesting historical things that are there, apart from the, from the story itself, which is a fantastic story.
Oh, yeah.
And that's yet another topic we have to treat.
I think with vampires, we especially see a lot of that interplay between fiction and folklore and what people actually report. So we're always interested in the ways that that sort of people can write novels and it will influence how people actually experience the weird and the paranormal, like
movies.
It feels like it sort of creates that. I call it a like socially available template, but yet it seems to like drive a lot of what people experience. It's very weird. I like it. It's very interesting.
And it draws also maybe on other aspects of the tradition, because in Romania I found out, you know, talking with the people there and the historians there, that there is a belief that the dead can, you know, in a way wake up and create problems to the living ones. And so they used to put really a stake through their body in order to stop them in the coffin. So it's not, you know, all make-believe. There were people really believing this stuff, and you can find them, yes.
Well, that's another one of those vampire things. It's, you drove the stake in not because it turns them to dust like in the movies. You drive the stake in because it pins them to the bottom of the coffin. That's where they stay, you know? It is fascinating, and there's so many monsters. There's so much lore, and we love it.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. This was really interesting.
Yes. You know, it's my pleasure, really.
Really enjoyed this.
And good luck at Harvard. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Exciting.
Next time we meet, I'll tell you the whole story.
Yes, yes.
Oh, look forward to it.
We will. Please do talk to us. And people can see you upcoming in October at SciCon in Vegas.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to have a workshop with my friend Richard Wiseman, with Ray Hall.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah, that'll be fun. Okay.
About magic, of course.
Yeah. Well, and Wiseman's always good for a pun, too. Yeah. He knows a pun or two. Tell him we said hello.
Absolutely.
Yeah, please do.
Yes.
All right. Well, have a great evening.
Thank you again. Yeah, have a great night.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Massimo Pollodoro talking about the 1954 Florence UFO incident. You can see Massimo live this month along with Richard Dawkins, Penn and Teller, and Bill Nye by going to the Center for Skeptical Inquiry's CSICon. CSICon will be in Las Vegas October 26th through the 29th. At the Flamingo Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Just go to csiconference.org to learn more. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for including us in your listening life.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.